This is a HeadGum Podcast.
While Andrew and Craig believe the joy of discovery is crucial to enjoying any well-told tale, they will not shy away from spoiling specific story beats when necessary. Plus, these are books you should have read by now.
Week I was gonna use, I had thought like a couple weeks ago about using the Borat thing as my opener and just asking you how many times I would be allowed to make the Borat joke.
Like, we're not talking about me or the fact that I'm your wife, so I feel like you would have to do some gymnastics to get to that.
Maybe. I don't know if I agree entirely. You don't have to let me because I
How
did
about
it.
Three. I think three is more than generous.
Three is
incredibly generous.
Three is a lot.
I have an open and giving heart.
Well, everybody, welcome to Overdue. This is a podcast about the books that you've been meaning to read. My name is Andrew.
My name is Craig.
That's not your name.
My name is Susanna.
And you're my wife. And I'll just get one out of the way, right out of the gate. So this week, we talked last week about where Craig is right now, and he's on his honeymoon.
He's on a plane right now.
He's on a plane. His wife, Laura, is also seated on the plane in front
of... Not with him, though.
Not with him. In front of TV's Seth Meyers, which is cool.
That's she a took cool... a super creepy selfie with him in the background. Extremely...
I imagine, like, in celebrity school, they probably teach you how to pick out somebody who's taking a creepy picture of you, right?
Yes, 100%.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, Craig and his wife are on their honeymoon, and so we need to put out some content because content makes the world go round.
Hashtag content.
So Susanna is here to read a book and to help me put together some good content.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much. Susanna, what did you read for the show this week?
I read The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas.
That's a good pronunciation.
I don't know how hard I'm going to lean into the pronunciation.
Listen, I've got a bunch of names over here in my author research, and I'm going to try, but don't, like, I'm not going to do very good.
That's fine.
Because French is, trying to pronounce French stuff as somebody who speaks English is just like, forget everything you know about what every letter means and sounds like.
There's just some extra ones in there. Just like, you have to know which ones to ignore.
Sometimes there are extra ones and sometimes you got to put extra That's ones true. In there.
They don't care, the French.
So what do you, have you ever read, so Alexandre Dumas. Is a he's a French writer, obviously. He was born in 1802 and he died in 1870. What do you know anything about him? Have you read any of his books before ever?
I have never read any of his books. I know that his other most famous work is The Three Musketeers.
That is true.
Which he wrote within like 2 years of writing The Count of Monte Cristo.
Yeah, he was a busy boy.
For that very brief amount of time. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of his life he was just like sleeping with many women and having illegitimate children.
Yeah, he had at least four illegitimate children that we know about, and scholars estimate that he may have had as many as 40 mistresses.
Wow. Like simultaneously?
Not simultaneously, just over the course of his life.
That's a very large time commitment. That's 40 mistresses?
It is. Well, I guess it depends on what you need to do to have somebody count as your mistress.
It's true. I think of this being in the French fashion, as I understand it, it's like a relationship.
Tell me everything
it's like
you
your
know
girlfriend,
about French.
Like on The Sopranos, a guma, you know?
Oh, okay.
Like, I think that's what a mistress is, sure. But I could be wrong. I'm not French or a man who has mistresses, so not an expert.
So I got a picture of Alexandre Dumas for you to look at, and... Look at this fancy boy, a fancy gentleman.
That is not how I pictured him.
Now, I can tell you that I'm really looking forward to seeing Tim Curry play him in a movie someday.
Yes, in a fabulous wig.
In a really, really good wig.
It's a very tall hairstyle
he has. So part of the deal with Alexandre Dumas is, his dad was born to like a French nobleman and an African slave. Who he like married.
Okay. So yeah. he's biracial.
So he's a quarter African.
He's a quarter African. Yeah. All right.
And yeah, he did sometimes deal with that in his literature. He wrote a book called George's.
You can just say George.
George. George. George. George. Yeah. And it one is known for using some plot devices that were later used in Monte Cristo. It was published before, and it also dealt with race and racism. And he sometimes, you know, stayed away from that in his work. But this is something we have from him on that topic. And we also know that he faced like discrimination from people. And we have some like I found one really cutting quote that in itself is also kind of racist, but I'm going to read it right now.
Can't wait.
He says, "My father was a mulatto, my grandfather was a Negro, and my great grandfather a monkey. You see, sir, my family starts where yours ends." Which is like a burn, a good racist burn.
I guess when you're talking about yourself, you're allowed to say things like that. And he's like flipping the script like monkey wise, but it's a little problematic. It was 1840 something probably when he said that, right?
Yeah,
like people didn't have
the
same sensibilities.
But yeah, okay. So that's race and Alexandre Dumas. I don't know if it comes up in Monte Cristo much, if at all.
Extremely tangentially.
Okay. So he's super famous. He was famous at the time. He's famous now. His works were translated into almost 100 languages. And yeah, like we said, Monte Cristo and Three Musketeers are his most popular things. But he's also written plays and articles and nonfiction and all kinds of stuff. His historical adventure novels, of which Cristo is one, those were often published as serials, which if you don't know what that means, it's not about...
It's a podcast.
I'm Sarah Koenig. It's...
MailChimp.
It means that they were published in small parts over long periods of time and then put together as books later. So Monte Cristo was published in a journal in 18 parts from August 1844 to January 1846.
When I read that it was published in 18 parts, because this book is extremely long, and I think there are 117 chapters, mm-hmm. and I knew it was published serially, and I had sort of just assumed that each chapter was an installment, mm-hmm. and so I was just sort of picturing people reading this thing for like 10 years, which when I found out that wasn't true, I was very disappointed, because I know this, and I knew that it was wildly popular, like extremely widely read and extremely well thought of, and... just the idea of people just waiting for 10 years to like find out what happens. I thought was adorable.
My mind doesn't go to it taking 10 years. My mind goes to like before they invented comics, like this would have been the Garfield of its day. So people would go to the newspaper and read a little tiny chapter every day.
Yeah.
For 117 different days.
I would have enjoyed that, but that's not the case. Neither of those is the case.
Neither of those. Yeah. It's just the,
it was a monthly periodical for 18 months.
It's just the boring thing. Yeah. And actually so scholars have been pretty active on him, especially going into like the late 20th century and into now. His last book was published in France in 2005, and then in English in 2007. It's called The Last Cavalier. And we thought it was lost until somebody found the scholar's name is Claude Chope or Chope. They found a nearly finished copy of it as a newspaper serial in 1990, and then he kept it a secret from basically everybody except for his editor and a couple people. So he converted it into a novel, like in novel form. He edited it, and then based on Dumas' notes, he wrote the last couple of chapters. And then wrote a sequel based on more Dumas notes that was published in 2008. Now, it does not have its own Wikipedia page, so I assume it didn't do so good.
It went great.
Yeah.
That's what you can surmise from that.
Is there anything like that you know about him that you want to make sure that we talk about? I have a bunch of stuff about his career, but...
No, that's fine. Yeah, go ahead. By all means.
So we already established that he got around.
Yes.
A lot. We already established that he suffered from discrimination sometimes. He did. So when he was writing serial novels, that was a good business move on his part. And he actually founded a studio with a bunch of writers who also were all cranking out stories. Now, there's this dude, Auguste Maquette, who assisted Dumas with a lot of stories, including Monte Cristo and Three Musketeers. And what would happen normally is like Maquette would come up with some plots and he would sketch out drafts and stuff, and then Dumas would go back in and he would fill in details and dialogue and come up with endings and stuff. But that's not, it sounds like he did kind of a lot of work.
Yeah.
And he took Dumas to court later and he got some more money out of him, but he couldn't get his byline added to anything. So he is still a footnote to this other guy's life. Sorry, Auguste Maquette. And also just partly because of the lavish lifestyle, like if you're living that 40 mistress life, you gotta spend, you know. And he was pretty popular for most of his life, and he earned a lot of money, but he also spent a lot of money. So he was often living from paycheck to paycheck, I think.
Yeah.
Is my impression. That's most of it. I mean, he got his career started when he was in his 20s. He was working for this guy, Louis Philippe, the Duke of Orléans. And
that was very good.
Thank you. And yeah, his first play was called Henry III and His Courts. And it was produced in 1829 when he was 27 years old. And then he kept succeeding after that and generating enough money that he could write full time. And then later in 1830, he was a member of a revolution that dethroned Charles X and put up Louis Philippe as like the president?
Emperor?
No, he was the president. And then later they came back and maybe he was the emperor. I don't know. Like, I'm not a historian and France is hard.
They went through some stuff.
Like 19th century French.
French. That's what they call them.
19th century French is a hard place
to
learn.
Yeah, there are a couple of revolutions.
Some revolutions. Some toppling of people.
Yes, it happens.
Yeah, you know, you win some, you lose some. So yeah, that's Alexandre Dumas. I had sworn that we had done him for the show before, but I guess we didn't.
Think so. I thought two Victor Hugos, who I could see how you might conflate those.
Yeah, maybe Scarlet Pimpernel is what I'm thinking of.
That's not Victor Hugo, but I mean, there was Les Mis and
I think
Hunchback.
Pimpernel is in a similar.
It is. Well, that is around the same time.
Yes, right. So that may be what I'm thinking of, because I think we talked a little bit about Three Musketeers when we did that one.
That's totally possible.
Yeah. Okay, so if you don't have anything else, I think we can take a short break and then we can come back with some book talks.
Great.
We live together. We are married and we live together.
More's the pity.
Yeah. And so that means we have to like feed ourselves and we eat together sometimes.
That's true.
And Susanna, what's one of the ways that we do that?
We order in.
Okay, that's one way.
We go to bed hungry.
I don't know if that happens.
No, I guess we don't really do that. We cook food.
Yes, we cook food. And sometimes, in fact, many times, we cook food sent to us by Blue Apron. They're the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. And they want to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. So what's going to happen is they're going to send you a box. It's going to be full of food. And that food all will come together into three meals that each serve two people.
Yes.
So for less than $10 per person per meal, you get to eat a bunch of good food. They've got chicken stuff. They got beef stuff. Did I say chicken already?
You said chicken. We never get the beef stuff. We wouldn't know. We can't really comment on the beef stuff because I don't eat beef. And so
I'm sure it's good.
Sure it's fine.
And so like, what kind of foods do you eat? Like what kind of upcoming meals do they have?
Coming up, we've got a salmon piccata with orzo and broccoli.
Nice.
I bet that's very good. Their salmon ones are usually especially delicious.
Mm-hmm. The cat loves them.
The cat is a big fan of salmon night here in the Cunningham Rosenberg household. Pork chops and miso butter with bok choy and marinated apple. I don't eat pork either, so we won't be getting that one, but it does sound very good. Vegetable chili and baked sweet potatoes with crispy tortilla strips. That sounds really good, actually. Most of their vegetable soups come out pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And spicy shrimp coconut curry with cabbage and rice. Those are some of the ones that we should probably be expecting in the next few weeks.
Yeah. We've been Blue Apron customers for a long time. It really helps us out because we don't have to do as much grocery shopping. They established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. So you get like sustainably sourced seafood and beef and chicken and pork that comes from responsibly raised animals. And a produce source from farms that practice regenerative farming. And a lot of the time they'll send you stuff, like if you live in a food desert or something like that, they can send you stuff that you're going to have a hard time finding elsewhere. And
yeah, they have a lot of really good ingredients. Like the one we had tonight was a salmon with a labneh cheese, which I believe is a Middle Eastern cheese.
And I don't even know where I would start looking for that
in
our grocery store.
No clue, but it was very tasty.
So if you would like to try out Blue Apron, you can check out this week's menu and get your first three meals for free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/overdue. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. Susanna, what's that URL again?
blueapron.com/overdue.
A Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Hey, sweetie.
Hey. What?
Hey, sweetheart. Dear heart.
This is not how we're starting.
Okay.
Okay. So I read The Count of Monte Cristo.
You sure did. Who's this count? What's Monte Cristo? Let's just really dig into it.
Who's running this ship, babe?
We're both running the ship. It's a partnership.
You don't know what the book's about.
No, I don't. I know the name of it, though. So I'm like just getting in early with that one part that I know.
We'll get there.
Okay.
I want to say, first of all, when I talk about the writing style of this book, I'm going to just talk about Dumas, but I also wanted to mention Robin Buss, who is the translator of this edition, and has noted that it's a particularly good edition, or good translation, I should say. There's a lot of idioms and phrases and things that you could easily imagine getting lost in translation from 1844 French, but it's not at all hard to read. It's very good. There's only one like strange translation that I thought was funny that I just thought I'd mention is that he uses the word adorable to describe a young woman.
Mm-hmm.
And the word adorable to me pretty much exclusively means like cute.
Uh-huh.
But in this case, he meant like worthy of being adored, like adoration.
Yeah, maybe that's one of those words like awesome that has lost its original sense.
Right.
So, okay, cool.
That one struck me funny when it came up. But okay. Robin Buss is the translator of this edition. I recommend it. So my first impressions of The Count of Monte Cristo, I volunteered to read this for this episode because...
just tell me about the reading process, because it has been a process.
Yes, it is. I believe it is the longest book I've ever read. It is longer than all three volumes of Lord of the Rings put together, which is the other longest book I've ever read.
Technically, that's six books.
Okay.
It's split up into two books over three volumes.
Okay. Fine. It is longer than Infinite Jest, but it's much easier to read than Infinite Jest, so that's
fine. That would almost have to be true.
Yeah. So the only thing I really knew about it was that it's a story of... wrongful imprisonment and escape. And I think upon reflection that the only reason I knew that is from the movie The Shawshank Redemption, where there's this scene where Tim Robbins is like shelving books in the library. Mm-hmm. And someone's like, oh, what's that about? And he's like, it's about a prison break. And they're like, oh, we should put it in the educational section, like because they're in prison. See, so that's literally the only thing I knew about it. And I thought that the whole book was about him being in prison.
Prison Break?
Yeah.
Like the show Prison Break?
Sure. I think I'd also thought that the Count himself was like a deposed nobleman who was, you know, wrongfully imprisoned, but that he was like a rich guy, like a political prisoner.
It's France. Like, but, everybody's a deposed
but
nobleman.
I think that I got from The Mask of Zorro. I think I mixed it up.
That's the Catherine Zeta-Jones one?
Yeah. not her character, the Anthony Hopkins character.
I'm aware. No, she was not actually the... Yeah.
So long story short, I definitely conflated this with two movies of which it has almost nothing to do.
Okay.
Speaking of movies, though, there are no fewer than 14 film adaptations of The Count of Monte Cristo, the most recent of which was in 2002 and starred Jim Caviezel and Guy Pearce and Luis Guzman.
Why? What was he doing there?
He's being a sailor.
He just walked on set and they're like, Luis, get over here. We need someone.
I have not seen this film. I can't vouch for its quality or lack thereof. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that just goes to show that it's an enduringly popular story. Mm-hmm. Sort of defies the ravages of time that some books fall prey to.
Even though it'd probably be pretty hard to assign in like college or something, just because it is
so long.
It would take so long to go through the whole thing.
Yeah, I read it. I think I read it in like a little over a month, but I read it like very fastidiously.
It was like the only thing you were reading, and you had set yourself a page count goal for every
50
night,
pages a day.
It was very responsible.
Yes. Well, I didn't want to let you guys down.
You're not slamming 200 pages of Infinite Jest in like 36 hours.
No,
like
I did
some
not
people
do that.
Did.
That sounds terrible.
Like some people did.
So I guess I'll start with the synopsis. Now, I do just want to say it is a very long book. It is going to... if you know this book, it's going to be tough to do a proper synopsis because it ranges over, I think, 30 years and has dozens of characters. And I was trying to think of ways to eliminate some of them to like streamline things, but it's also sort of folding in on itself and multi-layered that it's hard to do that effectively.
Now, is there like a main character or through line that we can start with, or where do you want to start?
So, okay, I guess I'll start at the beginning.
That is fine.
And I'm going to do my best with the pronunciations. We'll see how it goes.
Listen, everybody understands. Yeah. We got pronunciation police on Twitter. They'll let us know. They'll let us know what's up.
So we start with Edmond Dantès, who is a 19-year-old first mate on a merchant vessel coming into port. And the captain of said vessel has died on the voyage they're coming home from. They're coming home to Marseille, I think is how you say it, in the south of France. And during the course of his voyage, he stopped at Elba, the Isle of Elba, which
isn't that where everybody gets exiled?
That is where Napoleon was exiled.
Okay.
At this time.
It's the cool exile hangout.
Sure. So this is Napoleon's first exile. As you may know, he returned from exile and took over France again, only to be defeated at Waterloo and then re-exiled to St. Helena, I think, which is a more remote island.
You know, the problem with this is I don't think we exiled him far away enough.
Get him out of there. So the captain, the dying captain, tasked Dantès with going to Elba with a mission, a delivery that he had to make. Mm-hmm. And Dantès returns to Marseille with a letter from Napoleon for someone. And there is a, what's the name of his position? The supercargo on the ship, sort of the financial guy, the accountant of the ship. His name, his name is spelled D-A-N-G-L-A-R-S, which Danglers is like, now I looked it up like a good researcher and it's pronounced Danglars. And I don't like, see, I can say that. It is possible for me to say that.
Tell me more about Danglers.
You sound like such a schmuck if you try to say a very, very French word in the middle of an English sentence.
We can't spend this much time on how we're going to say everything wrong. Like, okay. What's the deal with Danglers?
So anyway, he is green with jealousy of Dantes' success and goodwill and the esteem that he has in the eyes of the crew and the owner of this vessel, whose name is Morel. Mm-hmm. So Danglars goes about trying to sow seeds of discord with Morel against Dantès. Mm-hmm. And he does not succeed because Morel's a great guy and Dantès is a great guy and great guys all think that each other are great. Dantès has a fiance in Marseille whose name is Mercedes, who he desperately loves. They're both super young, 19, but over the course of the book I kind of discovered that everyone gets married when they're like 17, 18, 19. Yeah,
it was the olden days. Yeah, that's just happened.
So
you gotta get married early so you can get your mistress list jump started.
So we have Danglars, who is extremely jealous. We meet Dantes' neighbor, whose name is Caderousse, who is very greedy and jealous of the potential money that Dantès might be coming into if he gets promoted to captain in wake of the current captain's death. Mm-hmm. And then we have Fernand, who is in love with Mercedes and is not cool with the fact that Mercedes is in love with Dantès.
Okay.
So the three of them hatch a plot. Actually, it's really Danglars who hatches the plot. And the other
when you get this many people together, you just have to start hatching a plot.
I guess. So they know about this. Danglars, anyway, knows about the letter from Elba. Mm-hmm. And at this time, obviously, being a Bonapartist, as they call Napoleon supporters, is not acceptable, seeing as how Louis XVIII is back in power.
When is this happening?
This is in 1814.
Okay, so this is his second wave, or
who's second?
Napoleon's
wave? No, Napoleon's exiled right now.
Okay,
this is during his exile. That's why they went to Elba.
All right, got it.
So this is after the deposed King Louis XVIII is back in Versailles.
Okay.
So they they draft a letter telling the French government that this sailor has information about Napoleon and is trying to betray the crown.
Okay.
So he gets arrested, and the crown prosecutor, who is like the attorney general basically, is super sympathetic to Dantes' situation, because Dantes does not seem like he is a conspirator. He has all the right answers for all the questions that he has to ask. He clearly doesn't know anything about all this. It's just a matter of circumstance. He was just fulfilling his captain's dying wish by going to get this letter, and he was sort of just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And the crown prosecutor, whose name is Villefort, he is about to let Dantes go.
Okay.
But then Dantes lets slip that this letter from Napoleon is addressed to Villefort's father.
Okay. What is the significance of this?
Well, Villefort does not want anyone to know that his father is in contact with Napoleon, the deposed emperor, because that could blow up his spot regarding his crown prosecutor position. So he throws him in this island fort, this prison fort.
How many islands you got? You're France. Aren't you like landlocked mostly?
No, France has a massive coastline.
Okay, maybe we'll edit that part out.
No, I don't think we can edit that part
out. How many islands can France have, though? It's a lot of islands.
It's a lot of islands.
It seems like you should have to split them up.
The islands?
With the other countries.
Many other countries also have islands.
But like every country should have enough islands that they can exile everybody that they need to exile.
I don't think the like volume of exiles is the issue here.
Okay.
So Dantes gets sent to the Chateau d'If, which is the basically Alcatraz for France. And it's really very sad, and he has this Dantes is such a pure innocent soul that he cannot believe that this is real, you know, that he cannot believe that this is actually happening, that this is actually the end of his life, you know, that he's never coming out of this prison. It's not a prison that people come out from. It's like,
right.
It's a permanent situation, which he knows. He knows what the chateau is, but he can't, like, he just can't believe it because he knows he hasn't done anything wrong. And he's just this idealistic, sweet, sweet boy who can't wrap his head around the concept. So he gets imprisoned, and he's there for 14 years.
Okay. How much of the book do we have? Like,
we are 200 pages in, bud, out of 1,200.
Oh, geez. So we're going pretty quick, huh?
Yeah, I'm doing my best.
No, you're doing great. I figured we were much less far into that.
I've skipped a few things.
That is fine.
Out of necessity.
Let's do that.
Like, there's this scene where we're like with King Louis the 18th. Like, King Louis the 18th is in this book as a character. Yeah.
Interesting.
And then there's multiple like layers of Dantes trying to, you know, bargain his way out, trying to speak to the inspector of the prison, and then there's a time where he despairs so much that he tries to start starving himself because, you know, at that point, I think he's been in for 5 years or something, and he doesn't really see any point in continuing. But right as he is about to, you know, succumb to his hunger and cross the threshold and to not really be able to return from that, he hears his neighbor prisoner digging in the walls.
Okay.
So
back to the Shawshank Redemption.
Exactly.
He's hiding it behind his poster.
He doesn't have a Rita Hayworth poster.
Of like, what kind of poster would you have in France at this time?
That's a super good question.
I think you would just have...
an opera singer.
Sure,
There's lots of scenes in the opera in this book.
Yeah, you would have a picture of your favorite opera singer. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so his neighbor is this quote-unquote mad abbot. And he's been there for like 20, 30 years or something. And because he's been there for such a long time, he has all these like... tools, and like he's written a book using like ink that he made himself from like fish bones and stuff. That's how long this guy has been
fish
in this prison.
Bone-y?
I don't know.
I mean, you can see the face that I'm making,
yeah.
But I need to just verbally express my displeasure at that idea. That
it's
whole
nuts.
Scene.
So over the next 5 years or so, the abbot imparts all of his incredibly worldly wisdom to Dantes and like teaches him like three languages and like all this philosophy. And in the meantime, they're trying to dig this hole to the outside of the prison.
Dumas knew a lot of languages. That was one thing that I forgot to mention earlier.
Yes.
He was a good language guy.
So does Dantes.
Yeah.
So it's sort of this interesting transformation of Dantes, because he goes in to the situation, pure innocence. He has no opinions. He says that a couple of times when he's being interrogated, when they're trying to ask him about his like political opinions. How do you feel about the king? How do you feel about Napoleon? He's like, I don't have any opinions. I love my father. I love my fiance. I admire my boss. That's literally all there is to me, Edmond Dantes. Huh. And over the court, and which is a very romantic, capital R romantic ideal to have, to just love things, to just be good and kind and not very political or
boring.
Directive. Yeah. During the course of his imprisonment, that obviously changes. He goes through a transformation, both of his intellectual capabilities, because he goes through all this sort of education with this abbot, as well as just sort of ruminating on the what's happened to him.
So he's just talking to this abbot guy, and he's thinking to himself, like, is he like reading anything?
Yeah, the abbot has like written all these books.
Oh, well, okay. I meant real books, but I guess your crazy cellmate's books can be good too.
I think the idea is that the abbot was so well read that he had all these books committed to memory. People used to be able to do things like that.
Yeah, I guess. Like, now I can't even remember more phone numbers than you're like yours and my parents' landline, but
I know my parents' landline from the house I grew up in,
not the current,
which is
one,
not
though.
The house they currently have. So then after he's been in there for 14 years and he's very well educated and just by the magic of deduction has figured out why he got put in, like he sort of explained the course of events, because he didn't know that he'd been betrayed by Fernand and Danglars and Calderoux,
sure,
or that Villefort had thrown away the key because of the implications of his father.
Right.
He didn't know any of that. But he's like telling just his sort of life story to this abbot, and the abbot's like, here's what happened. This guy hates you for this reason. This guy hates you for this reason. Here's the exact thing that happened.
This guy's
You're
a
welcome.
Pretty convenient plot device.
It's very convenient.
An abbot ex machina down here.
I want to pause for a second and just say that I really, really, really liked this book.
Okay.
I think it's great. Like, it's very well written. It's very sharp. There are parts of it that are very funny. It is just very well written, and the characters are interesting.
You would have had a harder time blasting through it like you did if you hadn't liked it,
I feel the need to say that, because I feel like some of the things I'm going to say and that I have said so far make it sound like I don't like it, because there are some convolutions and things that aren't exactly realistic with these magical powers of deduction and things.
Yeah, like sometimes when you're like surmising things, and I found this to be true of longer books too, sometimes when you're surmising things, it makes it sound like the plot has holes in it that don't seem like holes when you're reading, because you're aware of a lot of different subtleties and stuff. Now you're explaining it to me and it's like, oh, his cellmate, this guy in the cell next to him, is a mad abbot who knows everything.
That's correct. I mean, that is what happens.
But I'm sure
it doesn't feel doesn't feel stupid or too easy at the time.
Okay.
It's very well written.
Yeah.
And
but
it's,
you're
in a
like
it's in a certain style, and it's
hundreds of pages of stuff into like a 20-minute.
Right. Yeah. It's in a certain style, and it's, you know, in a certain time period where that sort of thing wasn't lazy writing, where the way it might today maybe be considered lazy
Back
writing.
Back in that day, like any kind of writing took work.
Well, so I just wanted to mention that, because I don't want to make it sound like I'm mocking this book or putting it down or anything, because I really, really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then, right as they're about to hopefully be able to break out of this prison, the abbot dies of a seizure.
Just too much knowledge in that brain. Yeah. His brain exploded.
And
that's what happens.
And Dantes puts the abbot in his room, facing the wall, facing away from the door,
right,
and sews himself up in the abbot's shroud that the guards have put him in.
Okay,
because he figures that they'll take the abbot out to bury him, and it'll be nighttime, and he can just sort of like sneak out real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out that on the Chateau d'If, they do not bury people in the ground; they throw them in the ocean with cannonballs tied around their feet.
That's economical.
It is. I mean, it makes good sense.
Actually, like, it seems like a waste of cannonballs. I take that back.
Well, I don't know how expensive cannonballs are.
I guess I don't know.
It's to keep, you know, I don't want bodies bobbing up and down in the channel.
Of course. No.
That's unsightly.
Yeah.
So they tie this cannonball around Dante's feet and throw him in the ocean.
At what point in this process is he like, I done goofed?
Too late, honestly.
I done goofed on this
he
one.
He should have realized it a little sooner than he does, because they're literally throwing him in the air, but he's like, oh, I'm going in the
Possibly
ocean.
Possibly I have erred.
Yes. Pretty much. So this kind of works both ways for him, because on the one hand, he's in a pretty desperate position, tied uh-huh. with a cannonball thrown in the ocean.
Yep.
But Dantes was a sailor and is super good at water stuff and swimming and whatever. So he gets in, he has a knife. So he like cuts himself free of this cannonball. There's that. It's also important.
He's like really good at water stuff, and also he has a boat or what. Like,
so he cuts himself free of this cannonball, like swims to a neighboring like tiny little island,
mm-hmm. where like 100 people are just standing there, right. exiled from whatever country right. they live in.
So the silver lining of this whole terrifying situation is that the guards then think that he has died. They think that when they realize that the abbot is in his cell and that they've thrown a live person in the ocean. Do you know what I mean?
No, I know. Just like, how did they figure he got in the shroud?
They found the tunnel.
Okay, so they assume that he died when they tossed him off the cliff.
They assume that he died. Most people would die if you toss him in the ocean.
I assume because they don't have a surprise knife.
Right. Right. So everyone just assumes that Dantes is dead, because no one would think that he could cut himself free from this situation.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets picked up by a ship of smugglers. And I forgot the most important part. Crap.
Whoops.
Okay, go back.
Okay.
This is before the abbot dies.
Okay.
He's dying. He's not dead yet.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells Dantes, P.S. I discovered this 500-year-old treasure map.
This book is doing a lot of stuff, huh?
He used to be like in the employ of this extremely ancient Italian family.
Mm-hmm.
And they had this insane fortune, which the knowledge of which got lost even to the family itself, because the evidence of it got destroyed in a coup of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
But he's pieced it together, and he says there's this massive fortune on the island of Monte Cristo. Which is a tiny, nothing little piece of rock with goats on it.
Yeah, you barely exile anybody to it.
You can't exile anyone there. Just goats. And so he tells Dantes about this island. Dantes like, cool. So he falls in with these smugglers. He manages to get himself to this island. And he digs up this massive treasure trove of diamonds and rubies and gold and all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So... that's the end of like the first section.
Okay. How many sections would you split this book up into?
Four.
Four? And yeah.
That's not like actually delineated in the, like, just to me, there are four stages of this story.
Okay, cool. So I assume like you can kind of blow through the rest of it for me. I wanted to like stop because you mentioned like you really, really like this book. Can you say at this point what you liked about it? Is
sure.
it like the writing? Is it, because I assume the translation helps too.
The translation is good. It's just very atmospheric. It's very evocative. It really, you know, there's a lot of sort of scenes of weather and landscapes and things.
Mm-hmm.
And it works very well. It's very beautifully described. Let me see if I can find a good quote.
And it always sounds like stage. It sounds like something's always happening.
Something is always happening. It is wall to wall, either plot or dialogue that is revealing important things.
Right. Yeah.
In the midst of his transformation in prison from a sweet, sweet.
From a sweet rube.
A sweet rube to a.
To a street smart knife guy.
More than that, to pretty much an angel of vengeance. Like, he basically becomes Batman in the later parts of this. Like, a vengeful Batman.
Sure.
I guess Batman is pretty vengeful.
Yeah. Like,
but it's like only the vengeful parts of Batman.
Okay.
Because he's fabulously wealthy. He has incredible physical skills. Like, after being in prison for 14 years, he does manage to like swim an extremely long distance after having been thrown in the ocean.
It's a Christian Bale sort of Batman.
He's incredible at swordplay. He's incredible at shooting guns. He's a genius, basically. He is basically a superman.
Same.
What is even the point of
it? No, I like saw the slow blink that you gave while you were blithely ignoring the thing that I said.
And in the midst of all that is his is the hand of God as he sees it. He sees himself as being an instrument of God for basically raining vengeance on his enemies, which is interesting because my experience with Christianity is that it's fairly like forgive people when it comes to that kind of thing. But he's gone the other direction with that.
On occasion, people have been known to subvert parts of religions for their own ends.
Never.
On occasion.
Okay, so I'm going to read a part of this where he's in prison at this time and he's sort of come to a revelation about who's done him wrong and what he feels like he has to do about it.
Okay, hit me.
Okay. Inevitably, as we said earlier, he turned to God. Every pious notion ever sown in the world and gleaned by some wretch, bowed beneath the yoke of destiny, now came to refresh his soul. He recalled the prayers that his mother had taught him and discovered a significance in them that he had not previously understood. To a happy man, a prayer is a monotonous composition, void of meaning, until the day when suffering deciphers the sublime language through which the poor victim addresses God. So he prayed not with fervor, but with fury. Praying aloud, he was no longer frightened by the sound of his own words. He fell into a sort of ecstasy. He saw God radiant in every word he uttered and confided every action of his humble and abandoned life to the will of this powerful deity, deriving instruction from them and setting himself tasks to perform. These tasks being the summary destruction of his enemies. So
he's only got like a few enemies, it sounds like.
He has 4 enemies.
Okay.
So
that's like really manageable, like vengeance wise. Okay. I feel like if you're like too big about it, you're not gonna get anything done.
So his enemies are his former coworker on the ship who really is kind of the worst of the bunch because he's the one who came up with the whole idea.
Right.
He's the one who was, you know, so jealous that he felt the need to destroy this man. Mm-hmm. Calderuz, who is just sort of a drunkard idiot. He's a bit of a patsy, but he's also like a violent criminal and murderer. So, you know, we don't feel too bad for him.
Yeah, right. Like you can be complicit in stuff without being like super smart about it.
We have Fernand, who was in love with Dante's fiance. Mm-hmm. And we have Villefort, who is the lawyer who sort of cinched the deal, whereas Anandez might have gotten away if it hadn't been for the fact that Villefort wanted to protect his family and therefore his ambitions. Mm-hmm. So after Dantes comes into this fortune, he starts calling himself the Count of Monte Cristo, and then 10 more years pass.
How old is he at this point? So he's in the thing for 14 years.
He went in when he was 19. He comes out when he's 33.
Okay.
And then 10 more years go
by.
Now he's 43.
Okay.
So in those intervening 10 years, this is a jump. We don't see those 10 years. But we can pick up from context clues that he traveled the world, explored Asia and Eastern Europe, and just is the most cultured, well-read, extremely wealthy, throwing his money at everything person you could possibly imagine. He's been slowly over the course of all that time been laying the groundwork for how he's going to exact his revenge.
Of course.
So in the intervening time, Danglars has gotten married and had a daughter. Mm-hmm. And Villefort has gotten married and had a daughter, and then his wife died, and then he had a son. And Fernand got married to Mercedes.
What?
Yeah. And they have a son. So basically, the essential plan that the Count of Monte Cristo, as he is now called, has is...
How does the book call him the Count of Monte Cristo now?
The book calls everyone many things over the course of...
Okay.
There's a lot of name changing.
Sure.
But yeah, during his time in prison, they call him Dantes. And then afterwards, they call him Monte Cristo.
Is this one of the ways that they kind of... That Dumas separates the book into sections? Is like, how are you identifying yourself? Yeah. Like, what is motivating you?
And it's also separating who he is as a person. Because Monte Cristo is very different from Dante's. Dante's was a
innocent,
kind
was a
person,
soft boy, and
Monte Cristo is the angel of death. So his plans basically lead to the downfall of all of his enemies, but without Monte Cristo himself laying a hand on any of them. He just sort of sows the seeds for them destroying themselves, which I imagine is very satisfying.
Oh, I bet.
So originally, he sort of is reaching out to get at them through their children. He befriends...
I don't know if I can get behind that, but okay.
They're adult children, but still.
Yeah, but like, don't blame him for the stuff they're doing.
No, it's not great. And he comes to that conclusion himself eventually. Right. So he meets Albert, who is...
Albert.
Who is the son of Mercedes and Fernand. And they meet in Rome... There's all these scenes of fabulous things in Rome, but I'm not going to get into it. Long story short, he saves Albert's life from a scenario that he himself constructed, of course.
Right.
And in exchange for saving his life, he asks Albert to introduce him to Parisian society when he goes home to Paris. So... Then he proceeds to just get in good with everybody because Fernand and Mercedes have become extremely wealthy under questionable, mysterious circumstances.
Okay. I assume they found a treasure on an island somewhere that their neighbor told them about.
Danglars became a banker and made a ton of money in stocks. And Villefort became the Paris crown prosecutor. And is also extremely wealthy. Mm-hmm. So I guess I can't really explain how he brings his enemies low without explaining some of the things they'd done in the intervening 24 years themselves. Okay. So what has happened? And this is all sort of revealed slowly. I'm doing a bit of an info dump, but this is revealed piecemeal, and it's quite effective the way that he reveals these things that they've done. Mm-hmm. So Villefort, the lawyer, was nailing the accountant, the banker's wife, and she got pregnant, and they had a baby, and then he tried to kill that baby, and bury it in the garden.
Okay, then it grew into a baby tree.
He was thwarted in this, and the someone took the box that had the baby in it because he thought that it was like a treasure that this guy was like burying in his garden, but it turned out to be a dead baby. Except he wasn't really dead, he was just almost dead.
Wow.
And
okay,
so the baby got resuscitated and grew up.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the baby grew up to be like a sociopathic criminal. So
I can't imagine what would have happened in that baby's past to make it.
Well, but like, he was actually in the end, he was actually given a pretty good adoptive home. That's just like bad blood will out, I guess, because both of his parents were pretty scummy. Mm-hmm. So there's that the baby who grows up to be a young man named Benedetto.
You got Benedetto, the sociopath baby. Mm-hmm.
He's a young man.
No, a baby. Baby always.
Sure, that makes it much funnier to think about the things he does later. Sure. So there's that. Fernand joined the military and betrayed the Ali Pasha of Greece, which was like the king of Greece something.
Sure, some high up Greece guy.
And sold his wife and daughter into slavery. Great.
Wow.
Everyone's like great.
0-2 so far,
Yep. Who's the other one? Got before for
now. Do we do Danglars?
No, Danglars. Oh, he basically made a fortune in stocks,
right?
But sort of by screwing people over.
That's how you make money.
He's just like basically cruel to his wife and his daughter and stuff, and has no thoughts other than his own best interests. But he didn't murder anybody, so that's good.
take him where you can get him.
Yeah. And Calderu sort of fades into the background. He comes and goes, but he's a much more minor villain. And he is, and Monte Cristo does not have as much of a vendetta against him because he was sort of an incidental person.
Was he the patsy you were talking
like he was there when they were drafting this letter to incriminate Dantes, but he wasn't one of the instrumental people in it. He just didn't do anything to prevent it.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty bad too.
Yeah, it's not great.
Silence
None of them
is
are
not
great.
An excuse no, to, it's not. Yeah, okay.
So anyway, So Dantes, or Monte Cristo, gets in good with like this whole society. Like all the, they're all friends. They have these other friends. There's like, it's a cast of about 20, 25 people.
Now, does he encounter them like face to face?
Oh, yeah. So,
and do they know who he is?
No, his time in prison.
I bet he's Diesel.
Just, you know, made him unrecognizable.
Okay.
Actually, I want to read, there's this funny part. So after he first comes out of prison and he's trying to make himself not recognizable, he goes to the barber and his hair is super long, of course, and he's got this big scraggly beard because he's been in prison for 14 years.
Right.
And he goes in to say that he'd like to have his hair cut and to be shaved. Mm-hmm. The barber looked with astonishment at this man with his long hair and thick black beard who resembled one of those fine heads by Titian. At that time, it was not yet fashionable to wear one's hair and beard long. Nowadays, a barber would be rather surprised that a man could enjoy such physical attributes should wish to deprive himself of them.
So it's like someone from Brooklyn time traveled to 1998.
Yeah. There's little bits like that throughout with just very little, like, sort of cheeky little winks to the readers, like, people had different fashionable ideas 30
years
ago.
And I guess you're sort of trying to burn the kids today with their long beards and hair, and they're all unkempt.
Exactly. Yeah. And another thing, because of the fact, I think this is partly because of the way the it was published serially, sometimes Dumas will write, the reader will recall that.
Oh, will they now? Yeah. You're not the boss of me. Don't tell me what to do.
But I honestly found it pretty helpful because sometimes I needed a little bit of a reminder of what had happened.
A 1,000-page book, like, sometimes it's good to just leave some breadcrumbs.
Just like, remember when they had this conversation? Yes, it's very
important.
That's
going to be relevant in a second. Very important. So.
So now all of the villains have their young adult children who are...
And the sociopathic baby.
Yes. Who are like 19, 20 years old-ish. So they're all about to be at the age where they should be getting married. So there are these in betrothals and all the drama that surrounds that. So Monte Cristo breaks apart all of these extremely advantageous engagements.
Can you just like tell me like a sample way that he himself manages to break up an engagement? Just so, like one of them, your favorite one or something?
Sure. My favorite one is that Valentine, who is Villefort's daughter, is engaged to be married to this very wealthy young man. Mm-hmm. And Villefort's father, as you recall, is this Bonapartist.
Still?
Yeah. But he's had a stroke in the intervening years, and he has, and this is very interesting way that he communicates with like blinks and stuff with everybody. And to break up this engagement, in the last possible minute before the marriage contract is signed, the grandfather, Valentine's grandfather, informs her fiance that he's the one who killed his father.
Oh.
He killed the fiance's father like 20 years ago or something.
Cool.
So that's fun.
Yeah, that'll break up your engagement.
And the thing is, it's not obvious how that's tied back to Monte Cristo, but Monte Cristo has just sort of laid the groundwork and everything falls perfectly into place because
I guess he must have just done a lot of research, like he did his research.
I guess so. The first of his enemies that he destroys is Fernand, who he reveals that Fernand betrayed his the person he was sworn to protect and sold his wife and daughter into slavery.
Okay.
And the way he proves that is that he bought said daughter out of slavery.
Here you go.
Here she is.
Here's the proof.
Her name is Idy, and she is like spectacularly beautiful, of course.
Natch.
And it's super icky because he's been bringing her up as his daughter since, because he bought her when she was like 11, I guess, and she's now 19 or 20. But then she's like falling in love with him. And I'm like, that's gross.
Icky,
I don't like that at all. They're not biologically related, but still, like.
No, it's not about being biologically related, Woody Allen. It's about, like.
I know.
It's. And an interesting thing, and I don't know if Dumas would have any like memory of this, but. Because he was the son of a nobleman and also a slave, when he was brought to France when he was young, he did have to be like legally freed first.
Yes, there's some stuff about that that when you go into France, it means you're free.
Yeah, like I don't know if that's coming from personal experience or if he was old enough to remember that, but that's probably a way that his heritage sort of sneaks into the to the book.
Because Fernand is dishonored in this way, because everyone now knows about these horrible things that he's done, it causes Mercedes and their son to leave him, and he kills himself. And
okay,
and then there's this plot where Valentine, Villefort's daughter, is trying to run away to marry the man she loves. And they do this sort of Romeo and Juliet thing where they give her some pill to make it seem like she's dead, but she's not. Turns out that Villefort's wife has been poisoning like everyone in the household to try to get everybody's various fortunes inherited to her instead of the people they're supposed to go to.
Come on.
And so when Villefort realizes that his wife has been poisoning his in-laws and his father and his daughter, he like locks her in a room with the poison and is like, poison yourself now.
Man, if you love poison so much, how about you just hang out with poison now?
He repents of that when it becomes apparent to him that he has done some horrible things too. When Benedetto, the dead baby, comes back to be like, "Yo, I'm your dead baby that you tried to kill," and he has to face what he's done as well. Mm-hmm. He runs home to try to stop his wife from killing herself, but it's too late because she's already killed not only herself but their 8-year-old son. And so
just a lot of driving people to despair in this. Yes. This is not my favorite.
And that is actually the point at which Monte Cristo, who's sort of like around for all of these events, it's not obvious that he's done these things, but
is there still a soft boy in there somewhere?
Well, so when he sees this dead child, he sees that he's gone too far and that he is. Thanks, good looking out for paying attention to that.
There's something about this that tells me I may have overstepped my bounds. Yeah.
So he feels super guilty, but he still continues to mess with his last remaining enemy. So
you just gotta limit the collateral damage. Is all.
Yeah,
Can't leave a job half done.
Exactly. So Villefort, he does not kill, but Villefort, upon seeing his dead wife and little boy, goes insane. So that's not great either.
Sure.
People just go insane, Like, I've never known someone to go insane from seeing something horrible.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't know if it's a modern thing or if it's just because we don't live in books, that doesn't happen as a plot device. Yeah. But I don't know.
And so then Danglars, meanwhile, the banker, who is trying to consolidate his fortune, because slowly over the course of the book, through Monte Cristo's machinations, he's been like siphoning off all of Dangler's money.
Right. Like that's all, like in Office Space.
Right. Because that's what he loves best in the world is his money. Dangler's then gets himself kidnapped by some bandits that Monte Cristo is friends with and we've been introduced to at the front end of the book that I didn't talk about because it's just too much. Mm-hmm. And basically what they do is they say they just keep him there until hasn't had anything to eat for several days. And he's like, please give me something to eat. And they're like, oh, sure. You want this chicken? And he's like, yes, I would like that chicken. And they're like, cool. It's 10,000 francs. And
that better be the best chicken I've ever had.
It was not.
Okay.
And so basically they just keep forcing him to give them more and more of his money in exchange for food and drink. And he can't, like, what else can he do? His only other option is to starve to death.
Yikes.
So eventually, once he has given them all of his money, except for like a piddling amount, Monte Cristo lets him go. So he doesn't end up actually killing the last one.
So here's a question, and I don't know if you have more plot stuff to go through, but here's a question that I have at this point in the book is are we still cheering for the Count of Monte Cristo at this point? Because it sounds like he's become a Saw-esque
serial
killer.
He's kind of like Jigsaw. It's hard to say because you stop seeing things as much from his perspective. The first section of the book where you're like in the prison and all, it's not in first person, but it's like
Close third.
It's close
person?
Third.
Okay.
And then later it's more it jumps around whose perspective it's from. Mm-hmm. And you see, various people, both good and bad, sort of what they're seeing.
But just like have you spent enough time with the sweet soft boy who is in prison that you
I still
like,
wanted him to win.
Sure.
I still wanted him to get his own. I just wanted him to, like, chill on the poisoning.
On the, like, the poisoning and the suiciding.
Yeah. And the collateral damage, you know? Because he sort of goes in with this mindset of that the wives and the children are, like, cut from the same cloth, you know?
Yeah.
You know, evil begets evil. But then he gets to know these people and he starts to... Not see it that way.
Maybe I'm oversimplifying stuff right. a little bit.
Yeah. Unfortunately, at that point, the seeds have been laid. What's the phrase?
No, you lay them. The seeds have been planted.
That is a phrase.
The groundwork has been laid.
Sure, that's probably it.
What are you trying to say?
I don't know. Don't worry about it.
All right, so you lay the seeds. And then they go up into plants.
And then he kind of can't stop it. Even after he's started to realize that...
Oh, like the machinery is in motion?
There you go.
All right.
That even after he's realized that, like, the children really aren't cut from the same cloth, mm-hmm. that it's really not... That's not a great way to go about doing this. It's like he physically can't stop it because the machine is already in motion, or he just can't emotionally keep himself from exacting his revenge because that's all he's lived for.
Yeah, because like that's a common and like can be a powerful story archetype is like the person who deserves it gets their comeuppance.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I got people in my life, I love to see them get their comeuppance. I'm sure
you
got
them
too.
You didn't have a nemesis. You said that once.
No, just because I don't have a nemesis doesn't mean I don't want people to get their comeuppance. Some people got comeuppance coming.
No, I will admit that, like, aside from the children's deaths and stuff.
Yeah, whatever.
It is kind of satisfying to, like, see them miserable. Like, I'm not happy
because
you
spent all this time, like, really close to him, and he's in prison because these four people were super jerks to him.
Yeah, so, like, when Fernand kills himself, I was not expecting him to kill himself. Like, I don't know what I was expecting, but right before he killed himself, when he lost all his money and his wife was leaving him and his son was leaving him, and I was like,
he's living a
this is great.
Living a country song.
And then he blows his brains out and I felt kind of bad about it. So I kind of identify with the Count of Monte Cristo.
Right,
there.
Where you're like, yeah, this is awesome. Oh, no, not that.
Yeah.
Crap.
So... So then at the very end, the young lady Valentine, who's the one who makes it look like she's dead.
Right.
The Juliet thing.
The Juliet style.
Yeah. And so she has been spirited away to the island of Monte Cristo, and her love interest meets her there, and they're given all this money, and Monte Cristo sails off into the sunset with Heidi, the very young girl who has been his essential daughter for 10 years.
Come on.
It's all right. It doesn't come across as weird. Like, clearly no one in this situation thinks it's weird.
Maybe this is another thing that I'm losing a little bit because you're just giving me the synopsis. Yeah. But
it struck me as weird, but I think that's my modern
sensibilities. Yeah.
Yeah. I do want to mention one other character who I didn't really touch on yet because she's not critical to the plot. So it is Danglars' daughter, I think it's pronounced Eugenie, I think is how you say it.
How you spell it.
E-U-G-E-I. No, it's Eugene, except with an I in the at the end. Eugenie, I think is how you would say it in English, but it's French. Anyway, so she is Danglars' daughter, and there's this whole marriage plot where they're trying to marry her to dead baby Benedetto. Because they think he's like this nobleman, because the Count has set him up to look like this nobleman right. as mm-hmm. part of this major plot. You may recall, probably not.
The reader will recall
that Eugenie and Benedetto are in fact half brother and sister, but nobody knows that except for the Count. They don't end up getting married.
I was gonna say, like, are we gonna do it like an Oedipus reveal here?
They don't
end
up getting married because Benedetto gets arrested for his many murders that he's
Benedetto
done.
Is my favorite party mix.
What?
I like the rye chips. In the Benedettos.
What?
Gardettos.
I don't know what that word is.
It's like, what if Chex Mix got fancy?
Gardettos?
Yeah, Gardettos.
Is that a brand?
Yeah.
Literally never heard of
this. Yeah, no, it's like super fancy Chex Mix with like more, like fewer cereal pieces and more of the other good stuff.
Like pretzels?
Yeah, more of the good stuff.
Huh. Does it have sweets in it? Or is it just...
No, it's all salty. And then... In recent years, they have made a version of it that's like the Oops All Berries that's just all rye chips.
Ew, just buy some rye chips then.
But they don't have a seasoning on them.
No, thank you. Anyway. So Eugénie is very different from everyone else in the book because she there's a very strong like.
Is she gonna be like the one who gets spared all this or what?
Hang on.
Okay.
Just wait. Because there's this very strong masculine feminine thing going on with all the characters, which is not surprising because it's set in the 1800s mm-hmm. and that was a big deal back then.
Sure.
Because there's like the ideas of being masculine, being decisive, being strong, being kind of a jerk, and then all the but that's how they all are.
The things still associated with masculinity and today.
And all the women, like some of them are quite intelligent, but they're all like just deferential and sweet and willing to do whatever their father or husband says for the most part.
Like you.
Some of them are
You have to correct me because that's not how our relationship actually works.
I'm just going to let it go. No. most of them are like that, but then there's a few like evil women, like the ones who are poisoning people and stuff. So it's this very like Madonna whore complex kind of situation.
Our modern sensibility. And nobody the women, can poison
anybody. Like Mercedes and Valentine, are always like on multiple occasions, they and several other female characters say that if X terrible thing happens, mostly their man leaving them, that they will kill themselves.
Okay.
I think 4 different female characters say that.
Okay.
It's a little depressing.
That's, yeah, okay.
And they just like faint at the drop of a hat, you know, just like very, you know, very era specific stuff.
Stereotypical, yeah.
Then comes Eugénie, mm-hmm. who is, just doesn't give a crap about any of it. She doesn't want to get married, not just to her brother. She doesn't know it's her brother, but she doesn't want to get married to anybody, which mm-hmm. is like unheard of. She wants to go and like live the life of an artist.
Okay.
She's a singer and like a musician and stuff. Sure. She wants to go and do that. She has this confrontation scene with her father when she's like, hey, I don't want to marry this guy that you betrothed me to. And he's like, you are going to because of financial reasons. And if you don't, I'm going to throw you out in the street. And she's like, all right, I guess I'll do it. But I just want you to know that I hate you forever. And she's just completely like cold and calculated and doesn't give a crap about anything.
It sounds like in this book it would be refreshing.
She's not a major character. She doesn't come up very often. Mm-hmm. And when she's first introduced, she's just sort of described as sort of masculine, like the most of the men in the society don't really care for her because she's very just like cold and aloof. And
yeah, sure.
And so you don't really think much about her at the beginning. And then the scene comes with her father where she's just like, I literally hate everything that I see with you and this house and all of this. And I'm like, do I love this chick? Like, is she just like the best part of this book? And as it turns out, she like runs away with her friend and like steals her father's money and dresses in men's clothes, like cuts off all her hair. So she looks and passes herself as her friend's brother. But there's a lot of hints that she's actually like in a lesbian relationship with his friend.
Interesting.
Awesome. So big ups for Eugénie.
It's pretty low key cool.
It was pretty cool.
High key maybe.
Yeah. It's like, you know, just two young women being friends is not surprising.
Yeah, I mean, but like in these old timey books, when two women are like intimate friends, like right. I guess you're supposed to assume lesbianism.
There's the scene where they're like in a hotel when they're like running away from Parisian society and they specifically ask for a room with 2 beds. But then there's a scene where they're like in the bedroom later and they're sleeping in the same bed. So.
Ooh. Interesting. Mm.
So. She's great. I love her. You never actually find out what happens to her other than that she runs away to Brussels.
I think you just imagine what happens to her and like she, and it can be as great as you need it to be.
Yeah, I agree. So, you know, it's sort of, there's a very interesting dichotomy. There's a lot of dualisms, you know, between, you know, there's the masculine stuff, the feminine stuff. Dante is before his prison transformation. Dante's after his prison transformation. And there's just very stark contrast between a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And throughout the whole book, especially the latter part where you're in this like very convoluted Parisian society with these betrothals and like you have to be seen at the opera, you have to be seen at this dinner. There's all these like the minutiae of upper class French life, which is very like proper and prim. But then there's this undercurrent under it of like these murders and incest and infanticide.
And just like everybody and poisoning just, everybody.
And everyone poisoning everybody. And it's this sort of the seedy underbelly of this very proper, lacy society.
And yeah, like that power, that is still happening in stories to this day. Mm-hmm. Like that's is that like the Desperate Housewives vibe even almost?
Sure,
like,
yeah.
Just like what lurks beneath the surface of this
quaint little like cul-de-sac in the case of Desperate Housewives, but it's like all of Parisian society in this book. It's very interesting because, you know, I find just simply the day-to-day societal dramas of these people to be fairly interesting in and of themselves, like who's gonna marry who and who said the wrong thing to who and who challenged who to a duel. Like I find that pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. But then like suddenly it'll just take a turn out of nowhere and it's like, oh, P.S. there's a dead baby in the garden, like
not again.
There's also there's a very touching scene where Mercedes recognizes Dantes. There's a scene where their son, Mercedes and Fernand's son, is before he knows that his father is a...
Yeah, I guess I was going to ask if anybody made the, like, connected the dots between...
So before all of his enemies die, Monte Cristo reveals his identity to them, which in some cases is what it takes to push them over the edge into their insanity or death or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Because I, on some level, it seems like they've been carrying the weight of that with them all this time.
Sure, sure.
But Mercedes recognizes Dantes instantly the first time she meets him, but she doesn't say anything because... You know,
and she was, what she was the one he was involved with before
right.
he went.
They were
away,
in love.
Right?
Like they had a very, you know, very simple but very real.
You would recognize me if I went to prison and got really like really chiseled and came back with like a cool beard and.
I think I would recognize.
And I was just
you.
Really cool, and I was trying to kill whoever you were with.
I mean, it's 24 years later. I don't know what you're going to look like in 24 years.
Probably still pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So there's a scene where Mercedes comes to beg for her son's life because Monte Cristo and the son are going to be in a duel. Mm. And everyone knows that Monte Cristo is like the best with weapons. So the chances of him winning are pretty high.
Yeah.
And so Mercedes comes to beg for her son's life. And here, what does she say? She says...
Susanna has... And I don't know how Craig does it. I assume he's just as fine by the seat of his pants like I am. Susanna has this gigantic 1,000-page tome with all these post-it notes with like character names written on them. She's very prepared, and I just need everybody to know
how much work I did.
How seriously she's taking this.
So she says, "Edmund, you must not kill my son." The count took one pace backwards, gave a faint cry, and dropped the pistol he was holding. "What name did you say, Madame de Morcerf?" he asked. "Yours," she cried, throwing back her veil. "Yours, which perhaps I alone have not forgotten. Edmund, it is not Madame de Morcerf who has come to you. It is Mercedes." "Mercedes is dead, Madame," said Monte Cristo. "I do not know anyone of that name." "Mercedes is alive, Monsieur, and Mercedes remembers, for she alone recognized you when she saw you, and even without seeing you, by your voice, Edmund, by the mere sound of your voice. Since that time she has followed you step by step. She has watched you and been wary of you, because she did not need to wonder whose was the hand that had struck down Monsieur de Morcerf." "Fernand, you mean, Madame," Monte Cristo said, with bitter irony in his voice. "Since we are remembering one another's names, let's remember all of them." Which is, like, pretty cold.
Yeah.
So, in the end, he sort of sets her up to live a comfortable life, but he doesn't go back with her. I was sort of expecting them to get back together, but they don't. He runs off with this young ingenue.
It's been too long.
Yeah, well, also there's this younger chick that he can get
with.
Yeah, so.
I mean, you know.
So, I mean, like I said before, I found it very interesting.
Is there anything that informs why you really liked it that we haven't really talked about yet? Like, you talked about Eugenie, you talked about like all just the twists and turns of the plot. Like, is there like when did you know that you liked the book?
Well, I think I started to realize it when it became clear that it was not going to be the kind of book I thought it was going to be.
What kind of
book?
Because
I thought it was just going to be a prison break book. Like, I thought the whole thing was going to be him in prison and like whatever relationships he forged with whoever else was in the prison, and at the end, it was in the end was going to be him getting out. I don't know why I thought that. I think because I'd heard it described to me in the Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, you had a thousand page book condensed to a line, and that's
right.
Like, that's
and they just described it as being about a prison break. Sure. So I thought that that was what the whole thing was.
Yeah.
So then there's this extremely detailed story, and it's. I wouldn't say it's hard to follow. It's well written enough that it's pretty easy to follow. But there's points at which like different characters are telling stories to each other about like various points in their histories. And sometimes I feel like the stories were like three layers deep, where someone was telling a story and then someone in that story was telling a story. Which again is well written, and so it feels
well, some
easy
some
to
of
read.
Those may have been like their own sections when they were published originally.
Yes,
like
I'm not sure. Things. Yeah, I'm not sure where the demarcations are of where they were actually published. You know, there's just the chapters is notated in here. Mm. But it's a very complete world. You know, as I was saying earlier when I was talking about it, that it doesn't always feel super realistic that, you know, this character basically is capable of all things like that. You know, it seems like it should be ridiculous because it is so convoluted and so multi-layered and this character is so omnipotent, mm-hmm. but it doesn't feel that way at the time. It feels just like,
it sounds like it's spread out far enough that you would, everything would proceed naturally from the preceding thing.
It's a good yarn, you know, like mm-hmm. when you're reading it, you're not expecting it to be hyper realistic, you know, the parts.
Well, at the time, that's all it had to be. Like you're publishing something one part at a time or 18 parts in a journal over a year and a half. You just have to like, you can't be doing some like deep symbolic, weird artistic thing. Like you just have to be like spinning a good yarn. Like people always want to know what comes next.
Yeah, I definitely want to know what came next.
Yeah,
some of it is pretty telegraphed, but that's probably my modern sensibilities. It probably wouldn't have felt that way at the time.
Or if it had, like people would have liked it. Like people would meet up at the, I don't know where people meet in France in 1840.
Salons, cafes.
Yeah, like people meet at the baguette shop and they talk about like what's going to happen next in the Count of Monte Cristo.
Yeah, I'm sure that is what happened. If mm-hmm. podcasts had existed back then, I'm sure there would have been lots of podcasts about where the Count of Monte Cristo was going to
go. Yeah, there would have been tons.
You know, they had podcasts about cereal.
And they would have had like an after, like published mm-hmm. after the story in the journal would have been another journal called The Talk of Monte Cristo, where Chris Hardwick or whoever would have written about what he thought about the book that you just read.
Mm-hmm. Chris Hardwick.
Yeah.
Yeah. his ancestor.
Name, right? Yeah.
Yeah, his name's Chris Hardwick.
Yeah, like Chris Hardwick Senior, Senior, Senior. Senior, Senior.
Sure. I definitely really enjoyed it. I recommend it to anyone who has enough time to Jeez, delve into it.
Good luck.
Yeah.
You better be doing a book podcast because...
Yeah, it's surprisingly funny. Like there's a lot of parts that are
it
very
sounds like there's some
like
funny
a,
stuff
a dry
yeah.
sort of humor but
like
but
even the funny. Even the dark stuff like there's probably some element of like gallows humor in like a baby being out in the garden and not knowing that it's not a dead baby or whatever. Was there anything in that vein that like caught you by surprise? I know you did it struck me funny earlier, but that was more about the translation.
If about the gallows humor specifically?
Yeah, or just about like how the book is unexpectedly funny.
I don't know if this is unexpectedly funny. It was definitely unexpected. So Monte Cristo has a ton of servants, you know, people who are attending on him in various capacities. And he has this one who's with him all the time who is a quote-unquote Nubian, which I think just means a black guy, who... he is a slave. Like Monte Cristo on multiple occasions when someone refers to this man as his servant, it's like, he's not a servant, he's my slave. I bought him.
Yeah, get it right.
Yeah. And his name is Ali and he can't talk. Here's the reason why he can't talk is because he was a criminal, I guess, or accused of something, and in the place where he was, the punishment for whatever crime he committed was that on the first day they cut your tongue out, on the second day they cut your hands off, and on the third day they kill you. Which is great. Yeah. Awesome. And Monte Cristo says, I had always wanted a mute slave. So I let them first day go by where they cut his tongue out. And then I bought him from the jailers. So, and I, And at this point in the story, at this point in the story, Monte Cristo is like clearly trying to like impress people. So it might not be true. He says things that aren't true all the time. But I was like, what?
It's pretty icky. Yeah. Like, what? Again, it's I am wondering how the book gets you to cheer for your protagonist.
Yeah.
And again, I just assume that it's because there are subtleties to this that I'm not getting. But yeah. Yeah. Sounds complicated.
It is complicated. There's a scene at a wedding where the narrator is sort of describing all the women in their dresses, and everyone's sort of dressed to the nines. And he's like, "Of course, at places like this, all of the most dressed up, elegantly attired women are always the ones who are the ugliest, and you have to really search for the pretty girls."
Jeez. Okay, Winston Churchill. Yeah. Like, what are you doing? What are you saying? Yeah,
exactly.
Cool. So you enjoyed the book?
Oh,
you did not.
Much.
You did not begrudge us making you read it?
No.
Good.
I think if one of you had to read it, you would have begrudged the other because it is very long. It takes
maybe
very
a
long time.
I mean, that's it's a very complicated like political landscape behind Overdue, the podcast about the books you've been meaning to read.
I would recommend reading it on an e-reader if that's the sort of thing you enjoy, because I'll tell you what, this tome is very heavy.
Well, you got to work out those forearms. You get swole forearms.
Sure.
Okay, so thank you all for listening. Craig usually does this part, so I'm kind of lost at sea. If you want to get in touch with us about this book, or if you just want to tell Susanna that she's super cool and smart, you can contact us.
I have no comment on that.
We're on Twitter at twitter.com/overduepod and on Facebook at facebook.com/overduepod. I want to thank at least some of the people who got in touch with us on social media this week. Christina, Daisy, Kate, Liz, Becky, Stephanie, Ricky, Melissa, Ms. Trevithick, Graham, Glenn again, someone called Talk Less, Smile More, Yerba Suena.
That's Aaron Burr. That's a line from Aaron Burr in the musical.
Yeah, no, I'm aware who Camille, the Unfriendly Black Hotties podcast, which we you should go listen to. Holly, Mead, period, Blair, period, and a bunch of other people. I did not do a list ahead of time because that's just like, it's Craig's job. It is Craig's job. So I'm not. And also, we have a website up at overduepodcast.com. I don't know if you want to like help. Do you know any of this well enough to like help, or do you always shut the
website?
Okay.
Overduepodcast.com.
There you go.
Yay.
Mm-hmm.
There's Twitter, which is.
We already did that one.
We did that one. Yep. Great. I wasn't listening. What else?
What about like the feeds where you subscribe? Oh, do you know those?
Stitcher
uh-huh.
and SoundCloud.
Uh huh. No, not SoundCloud.
Not SoundCloud.
Just Stitcher.
I don't know what SoundCloud is.
It's another thing. So Stitcher, RSS, Google Play, and iTunes. I'm just going to take the steering wheel back from you if you don't mind.
I didn't ask for it, so that's fine.
It's like maybe if you wanted to help. If you subscribe in iTunes, do rate and review us. Those ratings help us rise in the iTunes rankings. They help people find the show. We do not typically advertise or get word about ourselves out there any other way than like organically. So you guys sharing the show with people you'd like and with people you hate, that brings other people to us.
People you hate? No, keep those people away from it.
And like maybe people they hate are still good people and they are like books. But
so if you're a jerk and you hate people who for no good reason, then tell those people to listen to the podcast.
Also up on that website, overduepodcast.com, we have links to HeadGum, our podcast network, Spreaker, our podcast host, to our Patreon project, to Amazon links about the books that we have read and are going to read. And also all the other stuff that we're going to read for April.
What are you reading next week, Andrew?
Next week, I'm reading Silas Marner by George Eliot.
Have you started that yet?
I haven't started it yet.
Do you want to borrow my copy of it?
No, I have it on the Kindle.
Oh, you bought it already?
Right, yeah. Fine. Well, no, it's you go on Amazon, you get it for free. Sometimes those old books, you just get them for free.
Sure.
So thank you very much for listening, everybody. And thank you, Susanna, again, for reading that book.
You're welcome.
For being very nice and good and lovely to me.
You nerd.
And everybody, we'll be back with Craig after he's been on his honeymoon. Until then, try to be happy.
Try to be happy.
Oh, man.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.
And so get a little close to the mic, just like just a little close so you're a little uncomfortable. And then start talking just like in a, like you're given a, given like you're given a presentation or something. Or like you're talking on the phone. With your loud phone talking voice.
I don't know why I talk so loud on the phone. I don't know why. I don't talk that loud in like the normal times. It just, I'm on the phone, I feel like I need to enunciate. I'm sorry.
It feels like a Seinfeld, like, well, you got loud phone voice.
A phone loud. That's what
a loud phone.
Loud phone.
Loud phoner. She's a loud phoner,
she's
Jerry.
A loud phoner. That's gold, Jerry. It's gold.
Loud phoner.